This. You just came across it just now? Her father asked. This bridge of yours? 3 minutes ago, I was in Iowa, seeing a woman who knew about Manx. Lou frowned, heard Vic putting Maggie in past tense, but she went on before he could interrupt and ask a question she couldn't bear to answer. You don't have to take it on faith. Once you tell me how to use the Anfo, I'll make the bridge reappear so I can be on my way. You'll see it. It's bigger than your house. Remember Snuffleupagus on Sesame Street? Big Bird's imaginary friend? Her father asked, and she could sense him smiling in the dark. The bridge isn't like that. It isn't some make-believe thing only I can see. If you absolutely had to see it, I could bring it back right now, but I'd rather not until it's time to go. She reached unconsciously to rub at the cheekbone below her left eye. It's getting to be like a bomb going off in my head.
You're not riding off right now anyway, he said. You just got here. Look at you. You're in no shape. You need rest. A doctor, probably.
I've had all the rest I need. And if I head to a hospital, any doctor I see is going to prescribe a pair of handcuffs and a trip to the lockup. The feds think, I don't know what they think, that I killed Wayne, maybe, or that I'm into something illegal and he was snatched to teach me a lesson. They don't believe me about Charlie Manx. I can't blame them. Manx died. A doctor even performed a partial autopsy on him. I sound like a fucking nut job. She caught herself, eyed him in the dark. How come you believe me?
Because you're my girl, he said.
He said it so plainly and gently that she couldn't help hating him. Felt a sudden, unexpected sickness rising in her breast. She had to look away, had to take a deep breath to keep her voice from shuddering with emotion. You left me dead. You didn't just leave Mom. You left us. I was in trouble, and you took off.
He said, by the time I knew it was a mistake, it was too late to come back. That's usually how it is. I asked your mom to take me back, and she said no. And she was right to.
You still could have stayed close. I could have come to your place on weekends. We could have spent time together. I wanted you there.
I was ashamed. I didn't want you to look at the girl I was with. The first time I saw you two together was the first time I realized I didn't belong with her.
He waited a moment, then said,
I can't say I was happy with your mother. I can't say I enjoyed almost 20 years of being judged by her and always found wanting.
Did you let her know that with the back of your hand a couple of times, Dad? She said, her voice curdled with disgust.
I did, he said, in my drinking days. I asked her to forgive me before she died, and she did. That's something, although I don't forgive myself for it. I'd tell you I'd give anything to take it all back, but I don't believe that kind of line is worth much.
When did she forgive you?
Every time we talked. I talked to her every day in the last 6 months. She'd call when you went to AA meetings, to joke around, to tell me about how you were doing, what you were drawing, what Wayne was up to, how you and Lou were managing. She'd email me photos of Wayne.
He stared at her in the dark for a moment and said,
I don't expect you to forgive me. I made some choices that are unforgivable. The worst things you think about me, they're all true. But I love you, and always have, and if I can do anything to help you now, I will.
She put her head down, almost between her knees. She felt winded and light-headed. The darkness around her seemed to swell and recede like a kind of liquid, like the surface of a black lake.
I won't try and justify my life to you. It can't be justified, he said. I did a few good things, but I never got carried away with myself.
She couldn't help herself. She laughed. It hurt her sides and felt a little like retching, but when she lifted her head, she found she could look at him. Yeah, me neither, she said. I did a few good things, but I never got carried away.
Mostly I was best at blowing shit up, just like you.
Speaking of blowing shit up, Lou said, what are we doing with this?
He gestured toward the backpack filled with Anfo. He had a paper tag looped around his exposed wrist. Vic stared at it. He saw her looking, and he blushed and tucked it into the sleeve of his flannel coat.
Lou went on. This is explosive, right? How safe is it for you to be smoking in here around it?
Her father inhaled deeply on his cigarette, then leaned in between them and deliberately put the butt out in the ashtray next to the backpack.
Safe enough, long as you don't drop it into a campfire or something. The detonators are in that bag hanging off of Vic's chair.
Vic glanced around and saw a shopping bag strung over one post of the chair back.
Any one of those sacks of ANFO would be ideal for blowing up the federal building of your choice, which is hopefully not what you're planning on.
No, Vic said. Charlie Max is headed to a place called Christmasland. It's this little kingdom he's got set up for himself where he thinks no one can touch him. I'm going to meet him there and take Wayne back, and I'm going to blast his place into the dirt while I'm at it. Crazy fuck wants every day to be like Christmas, but I'll give him the fucking 4th of July.
Outside.
Every time Tabitha Hutter settled and went still, the mosquitoes returned, whining at one ear or the other. Brushing her cheek, she startled two of them, sweeping them off her and into the night. If Hutter had to work a stakeout, she preferred the car, liked air conditioning and her iPad. It was a matter of principle not to complain. She would die of blood loss first, sucked dry by the fracking little vampires. She especially wasn't going to grumble about it in front of Daltrey, who squatted down with the others and then sat there like a statue, a smirk on his mouth and his eyelids half closed. When a mosquito settled on his temple, she slapped it and left a bloody smudge on his skin. He jerked, but then nodded his appreciation.
"They love you," he said to her, "the mosquitoes. They all love that tender lady flesh, gently marinated in grad school. You probably taste like veal."
There were three others at the surveillance post in the woods, including Chitra, all of them dressed in lightweight black rain shells over tactical body armor. One agent held the sonic dish, a black gun with a mouth like a megaphone and a coiled black telephone cord stretching to the receiver in his ear. Hutter leaned forward, tapped his shoulder, whispered, "Are you getting anything out of that?" The man with the listening device shook his head.
"I hope they're getting something at the other position. I don't hear anything except white noise. It's been nothing but static ever since that little burst of thunder."
"It wasn't thunder," Daltrey said. "It didn't sound anything like thunder." The guy shrugged.
The house was a one-story log cabin with a pickup parked out front. A single dim lamp was on in a front sitting room. One of the shades was halfway up, and Hutter could see a television, turned off, a couch, a hunting print on the wall. Some girly white lace curtains hung in another front window, indicating a bedroom. There couldn't be much else in there. A kitchen in back, a bathroom, maybe a second bedroom, although that would be pushing it. So that meant Carmody and Christopher McQueen were in the back of the house.
"Is it possible they're whispering?" Hutter asked.
"And your equipment isn't sensitive enough to pick them up?"
"When this is working, it's about sensitive enough to pick up loud thoughts," said the man with the earpiece. "The problem is that it's too sensitive. It caught a blast of something it couldn't handle and maybe blew a capacitor."
Chitra rooted in a gym bag and came up with a can of Deep Woods Off.
"Thank you," Hutter said, taking it from her. She glanced at Daltrey.
"You want?"
They rose together so she could spray him down. Standing, she could see a bit of the slope behind the house rising toward the tree line. Two squares of warm, amber-hued light spread out across the grass, light from the windows at the rear of the house. She squeezed the button, sprayed white mist over Daltrey. He shut his eyes.
"You know what I think that big slamming sound was?" he said. "That fat bastard keeling over. Thanks, that's enough."
She stopped spraying. He opened his eyes.
"You going to be okay if he drops dead?"
"He didn't have to run," she said.
"You didn't have to let him."
Daltrey grinned when he said it.
"You enabled the poor boy."
Hutter felt an urge, clear and simple, to spray off into Daltrey's eyes. And there it was, the source of her discomfort, her restlessness. Lewis Carmody seemed too trusting, too good-humored, too worried about his boy, too kind to his ex to have had anything to do with Wayne's disappearance. He was, Hutter thought, an innocent. But she had hung him out there anyway, to see where he'd lead her, and never mind he could drop from a stroke at any time. If the big man stroked out, was that on her head? She supposed it was. We needed to see what he'd do. Remember, this isn't about his well-being. It's about the boys. Daltrey said, You know why I like you, Hutter? Really like you? You're a bigger son of a bitch than I am. Hutter thought, not for the first time, that she hated a lot of cops. Ugly, mean drunks who believed the worst of everyone. She shut her eyes and misted off over her head and face and neck. When she opened her eyes and exhaled to blow away the poison, she saw that the lights in the back of the house had gone out, had vanished from the lawn. She wouldn't have noticed it if she were crouching down. Hutter shifted her gaze to the front room. She could see the hall leading to the back of the house, but no one came down it. She glanced at the front bedroom, waited for someone to turn a light on there. No one did. Daltrey hunkered down with the others, but she remained standing. After a minute, he craned his head back to look at her. "Are you pretending to be a tree?" "Who do we have watching the rear of the house?" she asked. The second state trooper, a guy who had until now not spoken, looked back at her. His face was pale and freckled, and with his ginger hair he somewhat resembled Conan O'Brien. "No one, but there's nothing back there. Miles of woods, no trail. Even if they made us, they wouldn't run that."
Hutter was already stalking away, hands stretched out in front of her to protect her face from branches. Chitra caught up to her in four steps. She had to hustle to keep up, her handcuffs jangling on her belt. "You are concerned?" she asked. Behind her she heard a branch snap, heard shoes crunching in the deadfall.
That would be Daltrey, following in no particular hurry. He was as bad as the mosquitoes. She needed a spray to repel him.
"No," Hutter said. "You had a position. There was no reason not to hold it. If they leave, they'll go out the front door. That's completely reasonable."
"So?"
"I'm puzzled."
"About?"
"Why they're sitting in the dark. They shut the lights off back here, but they didn't come into the front of the house. So that means they're sitting in the back of the house with the lights off. Doesn't that seem peculiar?"
On her next step, her foot sank into cold, brackish water, 3 inches deep. She grabbed the slender trunk of a birch sapling to steady herself. In another yard, Hutter was in up to her knees. The water didn't look any different from the ground, a black surface carpeted in leaves and branches. As Daltrey came up along beside them, he plunged into the water up to his thighs, staggered, nearly fell. "We could use a light," Chitra said.
"Or a snorkel," Daltrey said.
"No light," Hutter said. "And you can go back if you don't like getting wet."
"What, and miss all the fun? I'd rather drown."
"Don't get our hopes up," Hutter told him.
Inside. McQueen sat at the table with them in the dark. He had the bag of detonators in his lap and had removed one and held it in his hand. Lou was not reassured to see that the detonator in no way resembled the high-tech devices used to ignite explosives on 24 or in a Mission Impossible film. They were instead little black timers from Home Depot, with curiously familiar-looking brass-ended wires dangling from them.
Mr. McQueen, dude, that looks like the kind of timer I used to switch on the Christmas lights when it's getting dark."
"That's all it is," he said. "Best I could do on short notice. The sacks are prepped, which means the compounds inside have been soaked in diesel and wired with a small charge. You just tie in the line, same as you tie in your Christmas lights. The black hand tells you what time it is. The red hand tells you when it'll turn on your lights, or in this case, go off with about 20,000 foot-pounds of force, enough to tear off the front of a 3-story building if the charge is placed right."
He paused and looked at Vic. "Don't wire them until you get where you're going. You don't want to be bouncing around on your bike with these wired up."
Lou wasn't sure what frightened him more, the knapsack full of ampho or the way the guy looked at his daughter, his watery pale eyes so clear and cool as to have nearly no color at all.
"I kept it simple and real Al-Qaeda," McQueen said, and dropped the timer back into the shopping bag. "This wouldn't pass state requirements, but it would do okay in Baghdad. 10-year-olds strap this stuff to their bodies and blow themselves up without any trouble all the time. Nothing will get you to Allah faster, guaranteed."
Vic said, "I understand," reaching for the backpack and pushing up from the table.
"Dad, I have to go. It isn't safe for me to be here."
"I'm sure you wouldn't have come if there was any other way," he said.
She leaned toward him and kissed his cheek. "I knew you'd have my back."
"Always," he said.
He held on to her, arm around her waist. His gaze reminded Lou of certain mountain lakes that appeared crystalline and pure because acid rain had killed everything in them.
Minimum safe distance for an open-air blast. That's a bomb on the surface of the ground, is 100 feet. Anyone within 100 feet will have their insides jellied by the shockwave. Have you scoped out this joint, this Christmas land? Do you know where you're going to place your charges? It'll probably take an hour or two to safely wire and set these things.
I'll have time, she said. But Lou knew from the way she held her father's gaze, from the look of perfect calm on her face, that she was full of it.
I won't let her kill herself, Mr. McQueen, Lou said, pushing himself up and reaching for the grocery bag full of timers. He plucked it out of Christopher McQueen's lap before the man could move. You can trust me.
Thick blanched.
What are you talking about?
I'm going with you, Lou said. Wayne's my fucking kid, too. Anyway, we had a deal, remember? I fix the bike, and you take me along. You don't get to go off and do this thing without me being there to make sure you don't blow the both of you up. Don't worry, I'll ride bitch seat.
What about me? Chris McQueen said. You think I could follow you across the magic rainbow bridge in my truck?
Vic drew a thin breath. No, I mean, just no. Neither of you can come. I know you want to help, but neither of you can go with me. Look, this bridge, it's real. You'll both be able to see it. It'll be here with us in our world. But at the same time, in some way I don't understand, it also mostly exists in my head. And the structure isn't very safe anymore. Hasn't been safe since I was a teenager. It could collapse under the weight of carrying another mind. Besides, I might have to come back through with Wayne sitting behind me. Probably will have to come back through that way. If he's on the bike, Lou, where are you going to sit?
Maybe I could just follow you back across on foot. You ever think of that? Lou asked.
That's a bad idea, she said. If you saw it, you'd understand.
Well, Lou said, let's go see.
She gave him a look that was pained and pleading, a look like she was fighting the urge to cry.
I need to see, Lou said. I need to know this is real, and not because I'm worried you're crazy, but because I need to believe there's a chance here for Wayne to come home.
Vic gave her head a savage shake, but then she swiveled on her heel and hobbled for the back door. She got 2 steps before she began to tilt over. Lou caught her arm.
Look at you, he said. Dude, you can hardly stay upright.
The heat coming off her sickened him. I'm okay, she said. This will be over soon. But in her eyes was a dull shine of something worse than fear. Desperation, maybe. Her father had said that any numb-ass 10-year-old could strap himself to Anfo and blow himself to Allah. And it came to Lou now that this was, in fact, a rough approximation of her plan. They pushed through the screen door into the cool of the night. Lou had noticed Vic swiping her hand under her left eye now and then. She was not crying, but water ran from the eye uncontrollably, a faint but continuous trickle. He had seen that before, in the bad days in Colorado, when she answered phones that weren't ringing and talked to people who weren't there. Except they had been there. It was strange how quickly he had acclimated himself to that idea, how little struggle it had been to accept the terms of her madness as fact after all. Perhaps it wasn't so incredible. He had long accepted that everyone had his own world inside, each as real as the communal world shared by all but impossible for others to access. She had said she could bring her bridge into this world, but that in some way it also existed only in her mind. It sounded like delusion until you remembered that people made the imaginary real all the time, taking the music they heard in their head and recording it, seeing a house in their imagination and building it. Fantasy was always only a reality, waiting to be switched on. They stepped past the woodpile, out from under the overhang of the roof and into the gentle, trembling mist. He glanced back as the screen door slapped shut again, Christopher McQueen following them out. Vic's dad snapped his lighter and lowered his head to set fire to another cigarette, then looked up and squinted through the smoke at her bike.
Evel Knievel used to ride triumphs, he told them.
The last thing any of them said before the cops came out of the woods.
FBI!
Shouted a familiar voice from the tree line.
Don't move! Hands in the air! Hands in the air! All of you!
A dull throb of pain shot up to the left side of Lou's neck, a thing he felt in his jaw, in his teeth. It crossed his mind that Vic wasn't the only one in possession of high explosive. He had a grenade ready to go off in his brain. Of the three of them, only Lou seemed to think hands in the air was more than a suggestion. Lou's hands began to drift upward, palms out, although he still held the bag of detonators, the plastic strap looped over one thumb. He could see Chris McQueen at the periphery of his vision, over by the woodpile. The guy was perfectly motionless, still hunched in the act of lighting his cigarette, the tip glowing, his lighter in his other hand. Vic, though. Vic bolted at the first shout, slipping away from Lou and staggering across the yard, her left leg stiff, refusing to bend. Lou dropped his hands and reached for her, but she was already 10 feet away. By the time the woman coming out of the woods shouted, "All of you!" Vic had thrown one leg over the saddle of the Triumph. The other foot was coming down on the kickstart. The motorcycle roared to life in a shattering blast of noise. It was hard to imagine that a bag of Anfo could be any louder. "No, Vic! No, Vic! No! I will have to shoot you!" cried Tabitha Hutter. The little woman was coming through the wet grass in a kind of sideways jog, holding an automatic pistol in both hands, just like cops did on TV shows. She was already close, 15-20 feet away, close enough for Lou to see that her spectacles were dappled with raindrops. She had two others with her, the detective Daltrey, and a state trooper Lou recognized, an Indian woman. Daltrey's trousers were soaked to the crotch, and he had dead leaves sticking to his pant legs, and he looked bad-tempered about it. He had a gun, but was holding it out from his body, pointed away and at the ground. Taking them in, Lou recognized, half-consciously, that only one of them was an immediate threat. Daltrey's gun was pointing away, and Hutter couldn't see through her glasses. The Indian woman, though, held her gun on Vic, pointing it at Vic's center mass, and her eyes had a tragic look to them. Her eyes seemed to say, "Please, please do not make me do something I don't want to do." "I'm going to get Wayne, Tabitha," Vic shouted. "If you shoot me, you'll kill him too. I'm the only way he's coming home." "Wait," Lou cried. "Wait, no one shoot anyone. Stop moving," Hutter shouted. Lou didn't know who the hell she was talking about. Vic was sitting on her bike, and Chris was over at the woodpile, hadn't taken a single step. It was only when she twitched the barrel of the gun to point it at him that he realized he was the one moving. Without thinking about it, and with his hands up by his head, he had begun to cross the yard, stepping between Vic and the police officers. By now, Hutter was just 3 long steps away from him. She squinted through her glasses, the barrel of the gun lowered to point at Lou's vast expanse of belly. She might not be able to see him very well, but he supposed it was like shooting at a barn. The challenge would be in missing him. Daltrey had turned toward Christopher McQueen, but in a sign of profound indifference, did not bother to even cover him with his gun. Lou said, "Hang on, no one's the bad guy here. The bad guy is Charlie Manx." "Charlie Manx is dead," Tabitha Hutter said. "Tell that to Maggie Lee," Vic said. "Charlie just murdered her in Iowa at the Here Public Library 1 hour ago. Check it out. I was there." "You were..." Hutter started, then shook her head as if to whisk a mosquito away from her face. "Get off the bike and lie face down on the ground, Vic." In the distance, Lou heard other voices shouting, heard branches splintering, people charging through the bush. The sounds came from the other side of the house, which meant they probably had as much as 20 seconds before they were encircled. Vic said, "I have to ride," and clunked the motorcycle into first gear. "I'm going with her," Lou said. Hutter continued to approach. The barrel of the gun was almost, but not quite, close enough to grab. "Officer Surinam, will you cuff this man?" Hutter said. Chitra Surinam began to move past and around Hutter. She lowered the barrel of her gun, and her right hand dropped to reach for the cuffs dangling from the side of her utility belt. Lou had always wanted a utility belt, like Batman's, with a grappling hook gun on it and a few flashbang bombs. If he had a utility belt and a flashbang bomb now, he could throw one and blind the cops, and he and Vic could make their getaway. Instead, he was holding a bag of Christmas light timers from Home Depot. Lou took a step back, so he was next to the bike,
close enough to feel the blazing heat of the shuddering pipes.
"Give me the bag, Lou," Vic said. Lou said, Miss Hutter, please, please radio your guys and ask about Maggie Lee. Ask about what just happened in Iowa. You're getting ready to arrest the only person who can get my kid back. If you want to help our son, you need to let us go.
No more talk, Lou, Vic said. I've got to leave. Hutter squinted, as if she were having trouble seeing through her glasses. No doubt she was. Chitra Surinam closed in on him. Lou held out one hand, as if to ward her off, and he heard a steely cranking sound, and found she had thrown one bracelet of the handcuffs on him.
Whoa, he said. Whoa, dude!
Hutter slipped a cell phone out of her pocket, a silver rectangle the size of a hotel soap. She did not dial a number, but depressed a single button. The phone blooped, and a male voice came through static.
Kundi here. You throw down on the bad guys out there.
Hutter said, Kundi, any word on the hunt for Margaret Lee? The phone hissed. Chitra said to Lou, your other hand, please, Mr. Carmody, your other hand. He didn't give it to her. Instead, he held his left hand up out of reach, the plastic bag looped over his thumb, as if it were a bag of stolen candy, and he was the schoolyard bully who had snatched it and didn't intend to give it back. Kundi's voice came through the hiss, his tone unhappy.
Are you feeling especially psychic today? We just got word, 5 minutes ago. I was going to tell you when you got back.
The shouts from the other side of the house were closer.
Tell me now, Hutter said.
What the fuck is this? Daltrey asked.
Kundi said, she's dead. Margaret Lee was beaten to death. The cops there like McQueen for it. She was spotted leaving the scene on her motorcycle.
No, Hutter said. No, that's impossible. Where did this happen?
Here, Iowa. A little over an hour ago. Why is it so impossible?
But Hutter hit the button again, cut him off. She looked past Lou at Vic. Vic was twisted around on the saddle, the bike shuddering beneath her, staring back at her.
It wasn't me, Vic said. It was Manx. They're going to find out she was beaten to death with a hammer.
At some point, Hutter had lowered her gun entirely. She put her phone in the pocket of her coat, wiped at the water on her face.
A bone mallet, Hutter said.
The one Manx took with him when he walked out of that morgue in Colorado.
I can't understand this. I'm trying, Vic, but I just can't make sense of it. How is he up and walking? How are you here when you were just in Iowa?
I don't have time to explain about the rest, but if you want to know how I got here from Iowa, stick around. I'll show you.
Hutter said to Chitra, Officer, will you please? Take the cuffs off, Mr. Carmody. They won't be necessary. Maybe we should just talk. Maybe all of us should just talk.
I don't have time to...
Vic started, but none of them heard the rest.
Oh, what the fuck is this?
Daltrey said, turning away from Chris McQueen and bringing up his gun to aim at Vic.
Get off the motorcycle. Officer, holster your weapon, Hutter cried. The fuck I will, Daltrey said. You're out of your mind, Hutter. Shut off the bike, McQueen. Shut it off now. Officer, Hutter yelled. I am in charge here, and I said, on the ground, screamed the first FBI agent around the eastern side of the house. He had an assault rifle. Lou thought it might be an M16. On the fucking ground!
It seemed as if everyone was yelling, and Lou felt another dull wallop of pain in his temple and the left side of his neck. Chitra wasn't looking at him, her head twisted around to stare at Hutter with a mix of anxiety and wonder. Chris McQueen flicked his cigarette into Daltrey's face. It hit below his right eye in a spray of red sparks, and Daltrey flinched, the barrel of his gun lurching off target. Chris's free hand found a piece of stove wood at the top of the woodpile, and he came around with it and clubbed Daltrey across the shoulder hard enough to stagger him.
Get out of here, brat, he yelled.
Daltrey took three stumbling steps across the mucky earth, steadied himself, lifted the gun, and put one bullet into McQueen's stomach and another into his throat. Vic screamed. Lou turned toward her, and as he did, his shoulder bumped Chitra Surinam. This was, unfortunately, a bit like being bumped by a horse. Surinam put one foot back into the soggy earth, bent her ankle wrong, and went straight backward, sitting down in the wet grass.
Everyone, lower your weapons, Hutter cried.
God damn it! Hold your fire!
Lou reached for Vic. The best way to get his arms around her was to put a leg over the back of the bike.
Off the motorcycle! Off the motorcycle! Hollered one of the men in body armor.
There were three of them coming across the grass with their machine guns. Vic's face was turned to look back at her father, her mouth stretched open in her last cry, her eyes blind with amazement. Lou kissed her fevered cheek.
We need to go, he said to her. Now!
He closed his arms around her waist, and in the next instant the triumph was underway, and the night was lit up with the thunderous rattle of machine gun fire. Out back. The sound of the guns shook the darkness itself. Vic felt all that noise tearing through her, mistook it for the impact of bullets, and reflexively grabbed the throttle. The back tire smoked and slipped across the wet earth, peeled up a long, soggy strip of grass. Then the Triumph jumped forward into the darkness. A part of her was still looking back, watching her father double over, reaching for his own throat, hair falling across his eyes, his mouth open as if he were trying to vomit. A part of her was catching him before he could sink to his knees, was holding him in her arms. A part of her was kissing his face. I'm right here, Dad, she told him. I'm right here with you. She was so close to him she could smell the fresh-poured copper smell of his blood. Lou's soft, bristly cheek was pressed to the side of her neck. He was spooned against her, the backpack full of explosives crushed between their bodies. Just ride, he said. Get us where we have to go. Don't look. Just ride. Dirt flew up on her right as she twisted the bike around, pointing it upslope toward the trees. Her ears registered the sound of bullets smacking into the soil behind them. Through the racket of gunfire, she picked out Tabitha Hutter's voice, wavering with strain. Stop shooting! Stop shooting! Vic couldn't think and didn't need to. Her hands and feet knew what to do, her right foot kicking up into second gear, then third. The bike scrambled up the wet hill. The pines rose in a dark wall before them. She lowered her head as they cut in between the tree trunks. A branch swatted her across the mouth, stung her lips. They broke through the brush, and the tires found the boards of the shorter way bridge and began to clatter over them.
What the fuck? Lou cried.
She hadn't entered straight on, and her head was still down, and her shoulder hit the wall. The arm went dead, and she was shoved back into Lou. In her mind, her father was falling into her arms again. Vic pulled on the handlebars, veering to the left, getting them away from the wall. In her mind, she was saying, I'm right here, while the two of them sank together to the ground. One of the floorboards cracked under the front tire, and the handlebars were wrenched out of her hands. She kissed her father's temple. I'm right here, Dad. The Triumph careened into the left-hand wall. Lou's left arm was smashed against it, and he grunted. The force of him striking the wall made the whole bridge shudder. Vic could smell the scalpy odor of her father's hair. She wanted to ask him how long he had been alone, why there was no woman in the house. She wanted to know how he kept himself, what he did to pass his evenings. She wanted to tell him she was sorry, and that she still loved him. For all the bad, she still loved him. Then Chris McQueen was gone. She had to let him go, let him slide free from her arms. She had to ride on without him. Bats shrilled in the dark. There was a sound like someone riffling through a deck of cards, only vastly amplified. Lou twisted his head to look up between the rafters. Big, gentle, unshakable Lou did not scream, hardly made a sound at all, but he took a great sharp breath of air and ducked as dozens, perhaps hundreds, of bats, disturbed from their rest, dropped from the ceiling and rained upon them, whirling through the dank space. They were everywhere, brushing against their arms, their legs. One of them whisked by Vic's head, and she felt its wing graze her cheek and caught a glimpse of its face as it flitted past, small, pink, deformed, yet oddly human. She was looking at her own face, of course. It was all that Vic could do to stop herself from shrieking as she struggled to keep the Triumph on course. The bike was almost to the far end of the bridge now. A few of the bats darted lazily out into the night, and Vic thought, there goes part of my mind. Her old Raleigh tough burner appeared before her. It seemed to race toward her, the headlight rushing over it. She realized, a half instant too late, that she was going to hit it and that the consequences would be brutal. The front tire smacked the Raleigh dead on. The Triumph seemed to snag and catch on the rusted cobwebbed bicycle and was already turning sideways and toppling over as it exited the covered bridge. A dozen bats poured out with them. The tires tore raggedly at dirt, then grass. Vic saw the ground fall away, saw they were about to tip over an embankment. She had a glimpse of pine trees, decorated with angels and snowflakes. Then they went over a steep drop. The bike turned, dumping them off the side. It followed them down, crashing onto the both of them in an avalanche of hot iron. The world cracked open, and they fell into darkness. The Sleigh House. Lou was awake for close to an hour before he heard a dry, quiet crackling and saw little white flakes dropping into the dead leaves around him. He tipped his head back and squinted into the night. It had begun to snow. "Lou?" Vic asked. His neck was stiffening up, and it hurt to lower his chin. He looked over at Vic, lying on the ground to his right. She had been asleep a moment ago, but now she was with him, eyes open wide. "Yeah," he said. "Is my mother still here?"
"Your mother's with the angels, babe," he said.
"The angels," Vic said. "There's angels in the trees. Then, it's snowing."
"I know. In July. I've lived in the mountains my whole life. I know spots where the snow stays year-round, but I've never seen the snow fall this time of year. Not even up here."
"Where?" she asked.
"Right above Gun Barrel, where it all started."
"It started in Terry's Primo Subs when my mother left her bracelet in the bathroom. Where'd she go?"
"She wasn't here. She's dead, Vic. Remember?"
"She was sitting with us for a while. Over there." Vic lifted her right arm and pointed at the embankment above them. The tires from the motorcycle had torn deep gouges in the slope, long, muddy trenches. "She said something about Wayne. She said Wayne will still have a little time when he gets to Christmasland, because he's been running himself backward. 2 steps back for every 2 miles forward. He won't be one of those things. Not yet." She was stretched out on her back, arms at her sides, ankles together. Lou had put his flannel-lined coat over her. It was so big it covered her to her knees, as if it were a child's blanket. Vic turned her head to look at him. She had a vacuity of expression that scared him. "Oh, Lou," she said almost tonelessly, "your poor face." He touched his right cheek, tender and swollen from the corner of his mouth to the edge of his eye socket. He didn't remember how he got that one. The back of his left hand was badly burned, a steady throb of pain. When they came to rest, the hand had been caught under the bike, a hot pipe pressed against it. He couldn't stand to look at it. The skin was black and cracked and glistening. He kept it down by his side, where Vic couldn't see it either. It didn't matter about his hand. He didn't think he had much time left. That sensation of ache and pressure in his throat and left temple was constant now. His blood felt as heavy as liquid iron. He was walking around with a gun to his head, and he thought at some point, before the night was over, it would go off. He wanted to see Wayne again before that happened. He had pulled her away from the bike as they went over the embankment, managed to roll so she was under him. The bike glanced off his back. If the Triumph had hit Vic, who probably weighed 105 pounds with a brick in each pocket, it probably would have snapped her spine like a dry twig.
"You believe this snow?" Lou asked.
She blinked and wiggled her jaw and stared into the night. Flecks of snow dropped onto her face.
"It means he's almost here."
Lou nodded. That was what he thought it meant. "Some of the bats got out," she said. "They came out of the bridge with us." He suppressed a shiver, couldn't suppress the feeling of his skin crawling. He wished she hadn't mentioned the bats. He had caught a glimpse of one, brushing past him, its mouth open in a barely audible shriek. As soon as he looked at it, he wished he had not seen it, wished he could unsee it. Its shriveled pink face had been horribly like Vic's own.
"Yeah," he said, "I guess they did."
Those things are me. The stuff in my head. When I use the bridge, there's always a chance some of them will escape.
She rolled her head on her neck to look at him again.
That's the toll. There's always a toll.
Maggie had a stutter that got worse and worse the more she used her Scrabble tiles.
Max had a soul once, probably, but his car used it up. Do you understand?
He nodded.
I think. If I say some things that don't make sense, she said, you have to let me know. If I start to seem confused, you straighten me out. Do you hear me, Lou Carmody? Charlie Manx will be here soon. I need to know you've got my back.
Always, he said.
She licked her lips, swallowed. Good. That's good. Good as gold. What's gold stays gold forever, you know? That's why Wayne is going to be okay. A snowflake caught in one of her eyelashes. The sight of it struck him as almost heartbreaking in its beauty. He doubted he would ever see anything so beautiful again in his life. To be fair, he was not anticipating living beyond the evening. The bike, she said, and blinked again. Alarm rose upon her features. She sat up, elbows resting on the ground behind her. The bike has to be all right. Lou had pried it out of the dirt and leaned it against the trunk of a red pine. The headlight hung from its socket. The right-hand mirror had been torn off. It was missing both mirrors now.
Oh, she said, it's all right.
Well, I don't know. I haven't tried starting it. We don't know what might have come loose. You want me to...
No, it's okay, she said. It'll start.
The breeze blew the dusting of snow at a slant. The night filled with soft, chiming sounds. Vic lifted her chin, looked into the branches above them, filled with angels, Santas, snowflakes, globes of silver and gold.
I wonder why they don't smash, Lou said.
They're horcruxes, Vic said.
Lou shot a look at her, hard, worried. You mean like in Harry Potter?
She laughed, a frightening, unhappy sound. Look at all of them. There is more gold and there are more rubies in these trees than there were in all of Ophir. And it will end the same here as it did there.
Ophir? He asked. You're not making sense, Vic. Come back to me.
She lowered her head, shook it as if to clear it, then put a hand against her neck, grimaced in pain. Vic looked up at him from beneath her hair. It shocked him how suddenly like herself she seemed. She had that Vic smirk on her face and that look of mischief in her eyes that had always turned him on. She said, "You're a good man, Lou Carmody. I may be one crazy bitch, but I love you. I'm sorry about a lot of things I put you through, and I wish like hell you'd met someone better than me. But I am not sorry we had a kid together. He's got my looks and your heart. I know which one is worth more." He put his fists on the ground and slid on his butt to be next to her. He reached her side and put his arm around her and hugged her to his chest, rested his face in her hair.
"Who says there's better than you?" he said. "You say things about yourself I wouldn't let anyone else in the world get away with saying."
He kissed her scalp. "We made a good boy. Time to get him back." She pulled away from him to look up in his face. "What happened to the timers? The explosives?" He reached for the backpack a few feet away. It was open. "I started work on them," he said, "a little while ago. Just something to do with my hands while I waited for you to wake up." He gestured with his hands, as if to show how useless they were when they were empty. Then he put his left mitt down, hoping she hadn't noticed how badly it was burned. The cuffs dangled from the wrist of his other hand. Vic smiled again, tugged on them. "We'll do something kinky with these later," she said. Except she said it in a tone of inexpressible weariness, a tone that suggested not erotic anticipation, but the distant memory of red wine and lazy kisses. He blushed. He had always been an easy blusher. She laughed and pecked his cheek. "Show me what you've got done," she said. "Well," he said, "not much. Some of the timers are no good. They got smashed while we were making our great escape. I've got four of them wired up." He reached into the sack and removed one of the slippery white packages of Anfo. The black timer dangled close to the top, connected to a pair of wires, one red and one green, that went down into the tight plastic bag containing the prepared explosive.
The timers are just little alarm clocks, really. One hand shows the hour, the other shows when they're set to switch on. See? And you press here to start them running.
It made his armpits prickle with monkey sweat, just holding one of the slick packs of explosive. A fucking Christmas light timer was the only thing between the two of them and an explosion that wouldn't leave even fragments.
"There's one thing I don't get," he said. "When are you gonna plant them? And where?"
He got to his feet and craned his head, looking either way, like a child about to cross a busy road. They were in among trees on the sunken floor of the forest. The drive leading up to the sleigh house was directly behind him, a gravel lane running along the embankment, a road barely wide enough to allow the passage of a single car. To his left was the highway where, almost exactly 16 years before, a stringy teenage girl with coltish legs had come bursting out of the underbrush, her face blackened with soot, and been seen by a fat 20-year-old on a Harley. At the time, Lou had been riding away from a bitter argument with his father. Lou had asked for a little money, wanted to get his GED, then apply to state college and study publishing. When his father asked why, Lou said so he could start his own comic book company. His father put on a puss and said, why not use money as toilet paper? It would come to the same thing. He said if Lou wanted an education, he could do what he had done and join the Marines. Maybe lose some of the fat in the process and get a real haircut. Lou took off on his bike so his mother wouldn't see him crying. It had been on his mind to drive to Denver, enlist, and disappear from his father's life. Spend a couple years in the service overseas. He would not return until he was a different man. Someone lean and hard and cool. Someone who would allow his father to hug him, but would not provide a hug in return. He would call his father sir, sit stiffly at attention in his chair, resist smiling. How do you like my haircut, sir? He might ask. Does it meet your high standards? He wanted to drive away and come back remade, a man his parents didn't know. As it was, that was very much what happened, although he never got as far as Denver. To his right was the house where Vic had nearly burned to death. Not that it was a house anymore, not by any conventional definition. All that remained was a sooty cement platform and a tangle of burned sticks. Amid the ruin was a blistered and blackened old-fashioned Frigidaire on its side, the smoked and warped frame of a bed, part of a staircase. A single wall of what had once been the garage appeared almost untouched. A door set in that wall stood open, implying an invitation to come on in, pull up some burned lumber, have a seat, and stay a while. Broken glass silted the rubble.
I mean, this isn't like Christmas land, right?
No, she said. It's the doorway. He probably doesn't need to come here to cross over, but it's easiest for him here. Angels held trumpets to their lips, drifted and swayed in the flecks of snow.
Your doorway, he said. The bridge. It's gone. It was gone by the time we hit the bottom of the slope.
I can get it back when I need it, she said.
I wish we could have brought those cops through with us. Let them right across. Maybe they could have pointed all those guns at the right guy.
She said, I think the less weight put on the bridge, the better. It's an avenue of last resort. I didn't even want to bring you across.
Well, I'm here now.
He still held a glossy package of Anfo in one hand. He slipped it gently back in with the others and hefted the backpack.
What's the plan now?
She said, the first part of the plan is that you give those to me. She took one strap of the backpack. He stared at her for a moment, the pack between them, not sure he ought to allow her to have it, then let go. He had what he wanted. He was here now, and no way she could get rid of him. She hooked it over her shoulder. The second part of the plan, she started, then turned her head and looked toward the highway. A car slid along through the night, the light of its headlamp stammering through the trunks of the pines, casting absurdly long shadows across the gravel drive. It slowed as it approached the turnoff toward the house. Lou felt a dull throb of pain behind his left ear. The snow fell in fat goose-feather flakes beginning to collect on the dirt road.
Jesus, Lou said, and he hardly recognized his own strained voice. It's him. We aren't ready.
Get back here, Vic said. She grabbed him by the sleeve and backpedaled, walking him across the carpet of dry, dead leaves and pine needles. The two of them slipped into a stand of birch trees. For the first time, Lou noticed their breath smoking in the moonlit, silvered night.
The Rolls-Royce Wraith turned onto the long gravel road.
A reflection of the bone-colored moon floated on the windshield, caught in a cat's cradle of black branches. They watched it make its stately approach. Lou felt his thick legs trembling. "I just need to be brave for a little while longer," he thought. Lou believed with all his heart in God, had believed since he was a kid and saw George Burns in Oh God on video. He sent up a mental prayer to skinny, wrinkled George Burns now. "Please, I was brave once. Let me be brave again. Let me be brave for Wayne and Vic. I'm gonna die anyway, so let me die the right way." It came to him then that he had wanted this, had often daydreamed of it, a final chance to show he could lay aside fear and do the thing that needed to be done. His big chance had come at last. The Rolls-Royce rolled past them, tires crunching on the gravel. It seemed to slow as it came abreast of them, not 15 feet off, as if the driver had seen them and was peering out at them. But the car did not stop, merely proceeded on its unhurried way. "The second part?" Lou breathed, aware of his pulse rapping painfully in his throat. Christ, he hoped he didn't stroke out until it was all over. "What?" Vic asked, watching the car. "What was the second part of the plan?" he asked. "Oh," she said, and took the other bracelet of his handcuffs and locked it around the narrow trunk of a birch tree. "The second part is, you stay here." In the trees. On Lou's sweet, round, bristly face was the look of a child who has just seen a car back over his favorite toy. Tears sprang to his eyes, the brightest thing in the dark. It distressed her to see him nearly crying, to see his shock and disappointment. But the sound of the handcuff snapping shut, that sharp, clear click echoing on the frozen air, was the sound of a final decision, a choice made and irreversible. "Lou," she whispered, and put a hand on his face. "Lou, don't cry. It's all right."
"I don't want you to go alone," he said. "I wanted to be there for you. I said I would be there for you."
"You were," she said. "You still will be. You're with me wherever I go. You're part of my inscape." She kissed his mouth, tasted tears, but did not know if they were his or her own. She pulled back from him and said, "One way or another, Wayne is walking away tonight, and if I'm not with him, he's going to need you." He blinked rapidly, weeping without shame. He did not struggle at the cuffs. The birch was perhaps 8 inches thick and 30 feet high. The bracelet of the cuff barely fit around it. He stared at her with a look of grief and bewilderment. He opened his mouth but couldn't seem to find any words. The Wraith pulled up to the right of the blasted ruin alongside the single standing wall. It stopped there, idling. Vic looked toward it. In the distance, she could hear Burl Ives.
"I don't understand," he said.
She reached down past the cuff to finger the paper hoop around his wrist, the one they had given him in the hospital, the one she had seen back in her father's house. "What's this, Lou?" she asked.
"Oh, that?"
he asked and then made a sound that was half laugh, half sob.
"I passed out again. It's nothing."
"I don't believe you," she said. "I just lost my father tonight, and I can't lose you, too. If you think I'm going to risk your life any more than it's already been risked, then you're crazier than I am. Wayne needs his dad."
"He needs his mother, too," he said. "So do I."
Vic smiled, her old Vic smile, a little rakish, a little dangerous. "No promises," she said. "You're the best, Lou Carmody. You're not just a good man. You are a real, honest-to-God hero. And I don't mean because you put me on the back of your motorcycle and drove me away from this place. That was the easy part. I mean because you've been there for Wayne every single day. Because you made school lunches, and you got him to his dentist appointments, and you read to him at night. I love you, mister." She looked up the road again. Manx had gotten out of the car. He crossed through his own headlights, and she had her first good look at him in 4 days. He wore his old-fashioned coat with a double line of brass buttons and tails. His hair was black and shiny, slicked back from the enormous bulge of his brow. He looked like a man of 30. In one hand he held his enormous silver hammer. Something small was cupped in the other hand. He stepped out of the lights and into the trees, disappearing briefly into shadow. "I have to go," she said. She leaned in and kissed the side of Lou's cheek. He reached for her, but she slipped away and walked to her triumph. She looked it up and down. There was a fist-sized dent in the teardrop-shaped gas tank, and one of the pipes was hanging loose. Looked like it might drag on the ground, but it would start. She could feel it waiting for her. Mank stepped out of the woods and stood between the taillights at the rear of the Wraith. He seemed to look straight at her, although it didn't seem possible that he could see her in the dark and falling snow.
"Hello," he called. "Are you with us, Victoria? Are you here with your mean machine?"
"Let him go, Charlie," she shouted. "Let him go if you want to live."
Even at a distance of 200 feet, she could see Max beaming at her.
"I think you know by now I am not so easy to kill. But come along, Victoria. Follow me to Christmas Land. Let's go to Christmas Land and finish this thing. Your son will be glad to see you."
Without waiting for a reply, he climbed in behind the wheel of the Wraith. The taillights brightened, dimmed, and the car began to move again.
"Oh, Jesus, Vic," Lou said. "Oh, Jesus, this is a mistake. He's ready for you. There's got to be another way. Don't do it. Don't follow him. Stay with me and we'll find another way."
"Time to ride, Lou," she said. "Watch for Wayne. He'll be along in a little bit." She put her leg over the saddle and turned the key in the ignition. The headlight flickered for a moment, dimly, then guttered out. Vic shivered steadily in her cutoffs and sneakers, put her heel on the kickstart, threw her weight down. The bike coughed and muttered. She leaped again, and it made a listless, flatulent sound. Brap!
"Come on, honey," she said softly. "Last ride. Let's bring our boy home."
She rose to her full height. Snow caught in the fine hairs on her arms. She came down, the triumph blasted to life.
"Vic!" Lou called,
but she couldn't look at him now. If she looked at him and saw him crying, she would want to hold him, and she might lose her nerve. She put the bike in gear.
"Vic!" he shouted again.
She left it in first while she gunned it up the steep, short slope of the embankment. The back tire fished this way and that in the snow-slippery grass, and she had to put a foot down on the dirt and push to get over the hump. Vic had lost sight of the Wraith. It had circled the blasted wreck of the old hunting lodge and disappeared through a gap in the trees on the far side. She slammed the bike up into second, then third, accelerating to catch up. Stones flew from under the tires. The bike felt loose and wobbly on the snow, which had now accumulated to a fine dusting on the gravel. Around the ruin, into high grass, and then to a sort of dirt track through the fir trees, barely wide enough to accommodate the Wraith. It was really just a pair of narrow ditches, with a mass of ferns growing in the space between. The boughs of the pines leaned in above her, making a close, dark, narrow corridor. The Wraith had slowed to let her catch up, was only about 50 feet ahead of her. Nosferatu rolled on, and she followed its taillights. The icy air sliced through her thin t-shirt, filled her lungs with raw, frozen breath. The trees began to fall away on either side of her, opening into a rock-strewn clearing. There was a stone wall ahead with an old brick tunnel set into it, a tunnel hardly wide enough to admit the Wraith. Vic thought of her bridge.
"This is his bridge," she thought.
A white metal sign was bolted to the stone next to the tunnel entrance.
"Park is open every day, all year round. Get ready to scream, 'Hip, hip, snow ray, kids!'"
The Wraith slipped into the tunnel. Burl Ives' voice echoed back down the brick-lined hole at her, a passageway Vic doubted had existed even 10 minutes before. Vic entered behind him. The right-hand pipe dragged on the cobbles, throwing sparks. The boom of the engine echoed in the stone-walled space. The Wraith exited the tunnel ahead of her. She was close behind him, roaring out of the darkness, through the open candy cane gates, past the 9-foot nutcracker standing guard, and into Christmasland at last. Triumph, one eternal Christmas Eve.